and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working from home on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today. Tuesday, March 23rd, 2021. A host community in Western Equatorial State accuses the United Nations of favoring refugees.
We ask the UNHCR as to why we are dividing people since they have been living together for long without any problem.
And a former community leader in Central Equatoria says more than 3,000 plots have been grabbed in and around Juba by powerful military and political officials in the government of South Sudan.
Lawless individuals, mostly actually senior members of organized forces, who violently actually invaded and confiscated legally owned plots of land and housing properties in various parts of Juba town. And as we speak today, over 3,000 pieces of plots and housing have been actually forcefully occupied with absolute impunity.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The host community around Makpandu refugee camp in Western Equatorial State are accusing the UNHCR for relocating members of the host community living in the refugee camp to a nearby land. A UNHCR spokesperson in South Sudan says the decision to separate the locals from refugees was made to reduce dispute over resources, including water. For VOA News, Seba Martin Murangi reports from Yambio.
A majority of the social services within the Makpandu refugee camp, which hosts Congolese refugees, are accessible to the host community. As a result, many South Sudanese families have decided to settle within the camp. Farmer William Isbon is among the villagers who left their homes in Yambio and moved to the Makpandu refugee camp. Farmer William Isbon is among the villagers who left their homes in Yambio and moved to the Makpandu refugee camp a couple of years ago to access services.
We ran to Makpandu refugee camp for better security and free education since the time of conflict began in Yambio, but now that we, the host community, have been told to separate from the refugees, we don't even have access to the refugee help while we have been told to go. Even there is no water.
Peter Augustine, a traditional chief in Makpandu, says late last year UNHCR officials asked the host community to vacate the camp and relocate to an area outside the camp. He says UNHCR officials told the local community that the agency would demarcate the land, provide clean drinking water and medical services, as well as plastic sheets for shelter when they leave the camp. Augustine says UNHCR has yet to provide the services it promised and says the host community feels they are being segregated. He says the host community has been living peacefully with the Congolese refugees and does not understand why UNHCR decided to separate the two communities.
We ask the UNHCR as to why we are dividing people since they have been living together for long without any problem, but they had no answer. They only said it does not look well to mix host community with the refugees.
Jane Titema, a woman leader in the area, says since 2016, the host community and refugees have peacefully coexisted in the camp. Tema says she is mystified as to why UNHCR asked the host community to move to an area where there are no basic services.
What we want is access to clean drinking water because there is no water where we have been taken. Another thing is a health center because since we have been separated, we need our own health center to avoid problems because a South Sudanese had earlier fought with a Congolese refugee over drinking water.
Ayofe McDonnell, a UNHCR spokesperson in South Sudan, says her agency recorded an increase in the number of conflicts between refugees and the host community over water and other resources in 2020. McDonnell says UNHCR, the Commission for the Refugee Affairs, and the NGO World Vision consulted with leaders of the two communities and agreed to find a solution to ensure peaceful coexistence. She says part of the solution was for the host community to relocate outside the camp to a nearby area and marked specifically for them. She says UNHCR will work with the partners to demarcate the land and provide water points as they have in other areas of Western Equatoria.
For the state government to improve the situation for all communities in Western Equatoria, in 2020, for example, we drilled 2 boreholes. One of them includes the host communities in Makpandu.
McDonnell says UNHCR is trying its best to help the local community but is dealing with financial constraints. The Makpandu refugee camp has a good health facility, primary and secondary schools which rank among the best schools in South Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Seba Martin Murangi in Yambio.
The former chairman of the Barrio Village Development Committee in Central Equatoria State says more than 3,000 plots of land have been grabbed in and around Juba Town by powerful military and political officials within the government of South Sudan. Martin Swaka says land grabs in Juba started way back in 2005. He says his community will seek all possible means to take back grabbed plots in and around Juba Town.
Lawless individuals, mostly actually senior members of organized forces, who violently actually invaded and confiscated legally owned plots of land and housing properties in various parts of Juba Town. And as we speak today, over 3,000 pieces of plots and housing have been actually forcefully occupied with absolute impunity. Some owners of these plots were mercilessly actually assaulted, beaten up, and even detained by these security forces and by these individuals. The current wave of massive land grabbing that is now going on beyond even the Juba town, and it has even extended to the villages around Juba, villages like Rajaf East, Gumbo, Luri, Mangala, Rombur. These are villages of indigenous people who are residing peacefully in these areas. And they have been cultivating these areas and they are residing in this area and doing all their activities in these areas.
Some communities in South Sudan depend on land as their asset because they use it for cultivation, they use it for a lot of other purposes, economic empowerment. With all this land grabbing going on in Central Equatoria State, specifically around Juba Town, what are you doing or other community leaders are doing to prevent this from going to other villages far from Juba? Because once nothing is done in Juba, and then it gives a ticket to the land grabbers to continue grabbing other people's lands in other parts of South Sudan.
You are absolutely right. The community leaders and the youth, and even some political leaders who are actually hailing from these areas around Juba, the villages around Juba, they have not been keeping quiet. The communities have organized themselves. These are law-abiding people. They organize themselves. They wrote petitions after petitions to the extent that the petitions were even presented to the office of the president at one point, to the office of the governors at one point, and the local authorities. But usually these petitions fall on the deaf ears of the authorities. And at one point, even the youth took the law into their hands. They went to fight back. That was actually between 2014 2013, but as many people who have been following the events there, the same organized forces and the same government security organs, they responded actually very violently to this youth. Some of them were even shot.
You are speaking with a lot of knowledge on what is happening in South Sudan regarding land and specifically in Central Equatoria where you come from. Given the situation that you are telling us right now, what is the way forward? What should be done?
John, I'm talking to you as somebody who is also affected. My family land in the village of Rajaf East and even on the other side of Gumbo. All our land has been confiscated, John. And we have been trying our best here and there through the legal means to find a way how we can be able to, bring back our land. But it is very clear that, the government of the day is not interested at all to protect the properties and to protect the life of the people who are actually residing in these areas. So as you rightly put it, this is a hugely potential cause of a continuous conflict in the country. These people now have been displaced. Many of them have already migrated to Juba Town. They become destitute in Juba Town. The youth are highly frustrated. And as I said, this is a potential cause of a huge conflict. You cannot have a country, a nation, which actually is supposed to be, you know, having a peaceful coexistence between the, among the communities of this country, to be in this kind of situation. At the end of the day, people will take law into their hand in order to defend, you know, their old ancestral land and their properties and their heritage. They will take the law into their hand, and there will never be actually a kind of a just peace in the country because of this kind of situation.
Martin, I have spoken to other members of your community, the Bari community. They told me that some of your community leaders are the ones actually who are involved in this illegal land grabbing. You know, if you like, using back doors. For instance, the chairperson of your community has been accused on several times that his silence means he's part of what is going on. How do you react to that?
John, this is, you know, people will always find ways of pushing away the reality on the ground. The communities, the community leaders have been talking. Maybe they have not been coming to the media in order to talk like the way now we are talking today. But they have been actually approaching all these offices in a legal and systematic manner, right away from the local government to the office of the president. And this is not something new. All the governors, I want to tell you, John, because I was there, all the governors that came actually through during this period in Central Equatoria, they have been approached. The only thing that the community probably have not done is actually to encourage the youth also to take the law into their hand and start arming themselves in order to face this situation. This is the only thing that the community is reserved, and they don't want to push, you know, us to that level of chaos.
Martin, I have spoken to people in Juba from different communities, especially people who don't come from the Equatoria region, if you like. They complain that when they go to the land commission or land department to apply for a plot, they are not given. And so it appears like the frustration has pushed some people to take the land by force. How do you respond to that?
Where is it on earth, anywhere in the world, that you find that all the citizens of that country, or majority of the citizens of that country, they need to move to the capital and they have to have a plot in the capital? This cannot happen, that you have to give them plots in the capital. So today in South Sudan, Juba probably is maybe holding a quarter of the population of South Sudan. And this quarter of the population of South Sudan, if everybody is to be given a plot in Juba and the people and places around Juba, for sure, John, all these villages around Juba will not even be enough. The people who are complaining that they have not been getting plots in Juba, and this is the reason why the excuse of them going out and taking the law into their hand and start doing that, these are the same very people who are actually grabbing the land or planning for grabbing of the land, but they're looking for the excuse. If we were to go to the statistics today, I want to tell you, our communities even around Juba have actually done some survey and demarcation and allocated over 5,000 pieces of plots to people who are coming to Juba free.
That's Martin Swaka, former chairperson of the Bari Community Village Development Committee. He spoke with me from Nairobi last week. In the second part of this interview, Swaka talks about the legal avenues available. Authorities in Sudan say the country is planning for a nationwide disarmament exercise in the coming months to collect firearms from civilians. The transitional government says proliferation of illegal arms has created instability in parts of the country. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Sudanese officials say the existence of firearms in the hands of civilians threatens the implementation of the Juba Peace Agreement. is speaking at a seminar in Khartoum on Monday, organized by the African Center for Governance and Peace Studies. Muhammad Al-Ghali, the Secretary General for the Sovereign Council, says despite months of cessation of hostilities in war-affected areas, illegal firearms continue to cause instability in many parts of the country. Al-Ghali says many Sudanese lost their lives in intercommunal conflicts over land and cattle or during attacks by armed robbers.
We lost a lot of sons and daughters of this beautiful country, and we wasted a good amount of resources and saw a decline in development projects, all due to intercommunal and social conflicts, which are mainly caused by the spread of illegal arms. This has increased displacement, migration, and the number of refugees among victims such as widows, orphans, and missing individuals.
The African Center for Governance and Peace Studies recently presented a nationwide disarmament plan to the government, suggesting some long-term solutions to prevent the proliferation of guns in the hands of civilians. Speaking at the same seminar, the center's Secretary General Muhammad Zainal Abidin says Sudan has the largest number of unauthorized firearms in the region. Along with carrying out a disarmament campaign, he says the government must focus on cattle migration, good governance, the equal distribution of resources, and it must empower local authorities to address the matter.
This project has been asked of all African countries, and Sudan was the first country to begin taking serious steps towards the implementation of this project. Sudan has been affected by the spread of illegal arms, and this has affected the country socially, economically, and in terms of security.
Adam Rijal, the official spokesperson of the internally displaced person in Darfur camps, has welcomed the plan, saying it would relieve the suffering of many civilians, especially women, children, and the elderly. Speaking via a messaging application from Al Janina town of West Darfur State, Rijal says the proliferation of illegal arms in Darfur is the main cause of insecurity. He accuses some government officials of giving arms to Darfur civilians and instigating conflict between local communities.
Those who possess firearms are well known to the government, and some of them are members of the current transitional government. They know very well whom they give the guns to. The IDPs are targeted, killed, and women are raped when they go out farming, collecting firewood, or going to the local markets.
A Sudanese humanitarian worker who identifies herself only as Redab for safety reasons says the proliferation of weapons in the hands of civilians has affected her work. Speaking by phone in Khartoum, Redab says if the disarmament plan is executed, it will help humanitarian workers carry out their work.
We really suffered from this issue. There are continuous clashes between nomads and IDPs, which hinder the service delivery. You cannot cross some boundaries, even if you want to distribute water to the needy.
The deputy head of the Sovereign Council, Muhammad Hamdan Dagalo, vows to implement the plan soon. He is urging civilians to fully cooperate with the authorities and peacefully offer up their firearms. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a new study shows COVID could affect the heart. That story is lined up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what puts a smile on your face?
I have a group called Lishi. It's a group full of young children. So when I dance with them, it puts a smile on my face. Makes me happy.
What puts a smile on my face is good food and good people.
Okay, when I see good food and good friends around, well, I smile.
My husband, to me, puts a smile on my face. He cracks jokes. He likes cracking jokes, and that makes me happy.
One thing that puts a smile on my face is to see somebody who's been in trouble or who has had great challenges, and then he has broken through, his life is better, their lives have improved, their marriages, their business. It brings joy to my heart to see people becoming better.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. And in our Tuesday health segment, we take a look at how COVID affects the heart. Scientists are still learning how the coronavirus affects the body and why it's so lethal. A Cleveland Clinic survey indicates more than half of those questioned did not know COVID could affect their hearts, and nearly 70% did not know that high blood pressure also increases the risk if they get the virus. VOA's Carol Pearson reports.
One thing cardiologists know by now, people with heart problems have a higher risk for serious complications if they get COVID-19. Yet many people are unaware of this. Dr. Samir Kapadia is chair of cardiovascular medicine at Cleveland Clinic.
Many people know that it affects the lungs, but it can also affect the heart, the pumping function of the heart, the clotting mechanisms in the blood. All of this put you to a very high risk of having cardiovascular problems.
COVID can also damage healthy hearts, even if people don't show any symptoms. Dr. Alan Anderson is the chief of cardiology at the University of Texas Health Science Center.
We see patients who have likely had viral infections that they didn't even recognize, and yet they manifest with heart failure symptoms months or years later. So there could be a long-term implication to the health of patients who have been affected by COVID-19.
Dr. Anderson says this is true even for some patients who had healthy hearts before getting the coronavirus.
They had elevations of blood enzyme markers that were consistent with a heart attack, even though they didn't have any blockages in their coronary arteries. They had heart rhythm disturbances, and that this occurred with quite high prevalence.
Emotional stress also plays a role, says Dr. Kapadia.
People who have fear, people who have anger, it has been shown that both of these can lead to blood clotting mechanisms and can cause heart attacks.
Some of the heart damage doctors are seeing is reversible, but some is not, and it can lead to death. At the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio, researchers are testing an antibiotic and a medication for diabetes. They want to see if these drugs can prevent heart damage in COVID patients. Antibiotics fight bacterial infections. They don't work on viruses. But there are tiny, bean-shaped parts inside our cells called mitochondria. Mitochondria generate chemical energy and drive many of our body's functions, including our heartbeat. Scientists believe that mitochondria evolved from a type of bacteria, so an antibiotic might protect them from the coronavirus, and the mitochondria, in turn, would protect the heart. The diabetes drug being tested also helps mitochondria continue to produce energy. The researchers hope to start clinical trials with people who have recovered from the coronavirus so doctors can see if the volunteers' hearts continue to function well long after they have recovered from COVID-19. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
A family member of a soldier who fell off a military vehicle in a convoy of Vice President Hussein Abdelbaghi accuses the Vice President's office of ignoring the man's plight. The man's brother says initially the office of the Vice President paid for his brother's medication in Juba, but after being referred to Khartoum for more treatment, the office has ignored them. A spokesperson in the office of the Vice President says the office cannot offer full support because the wounded soldier is not a staff member. For VOA News, Winnie Chirino reports from Juba.
Tangarang, the elder brother of Kolkon, who fell off a Land Cruiser, says his brother asked for a lift from the head of Abdelbaghi's convoy and was accepted because he was a soldier and was returning to Juba to work. Garang says the accident happened on the Baragazal Road when the convoy was returning to Juba.
My brother had gone to the village and wanted to return to his workplace. Before they reached a place called Aburi with the convoy of the Vice President, the driver lost control and my brother fell off the car. Then he was brought to Rumbek Hospital the following morning on Sunday. He was brought to us in Juba. I took him to military hospital and the doctor said we go for x-ray. When we returned, the doctor was not there and my brother was badly off and was bleeding from his mouth and nose.
Grang says, based on reports from the soldiers who were in the convoy, the driver was drunk. He says when there was no doctor to attend to his brother after the x-ray, he took him to a Chinese hospital in Juba, which was closed. Grang says he later took his brother to Freedom International Hospital in Juba, where he received treatment. Grang says Vice President Abdul Baji's office gave him 360,000 South Sudanese pounds, or about $600 in black market, which he used to pay the medical bills at Freedom International Hospital, but have since then been kicked out of the hospital.
Now we are staying with him at home. If there is any medicine the doctor had prescribed for us, we buy and give him. We were admitted in a private hospital, which is expensive. So when these people treated him, they wrote a bill and said, we need this money and you go, because a lot of medicine was administered, but there is no change. So they told us, you refer your patient if you can afford, or go to Vice President's office to help you refer him to Khartoum to get treatment.
Garang says his brother was referred to Royal International Hospital in Khartoum for further treatment. He says when he informed the Vice President Abdul Baji's office, the staff avoids him.
They told me to go and prepare the documents. I went and prepared them, and now it's going to 3 weeks. Nothing has been done, and I said, if this man dies in my hands, my relatives are far in Baragazal. There is no one to help me here. The Vice President does not want to help me. If my brother dies, what will I do?
Gabriel Kerr, a spokesperson in Vice President Abdul Baji's office, says there is no staff member by the name Kwal Khan in his office. He says Khan asked for a lift just like any other ordinary person who may need assistance, and that despite being told not to embark on the journey, he insisted he needed a ride and boarded. He says after learning of the incident, the office supported the victim so that his condition doesn't worsen, but says the Vice President's office cannot shoulder the treatment 100%.
We do not have to necessarily fund the trip because we are not legally bound to do so because of the fact that the victim is not our staff. He was not part of the convoy. We only assisted this person at his request. What we can do is to share the cost of what of the expenditure, which we have already done, by the way. We had assisted.
In a letter seen by South Sudan in Focus, Khan is diagnosed with hemiplegia, deafness, and inability to communicate. According to Royal International Hospital, he requires $35,000 to undergo treatment for his condition. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sereno in Juba.
That's all we prepared for you today. Let's know what you think about this show. Our WhatsApp number is +12026308011. When I leave you with D Kut with the song Pir Aher. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes, phones, and vehicles. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect you and others from COVID. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Wukai kol chilun wei, banyuru jengre kwa tu wei nyindugo. kai bako kedua leben
jengeru jengeru
aku lepanda berawi
jengeru jengeru
dan jam bumit ke sausu
jengeru jengeru
walun wai nyintuku
jengeru jengeru
wakai kot ke baci dong pan
jengeru jengeru
ku yak ke pinggu yak ke jam nge jam yak ke jam we dorur pione panduk acin doru kunwe rai mit ke dingduk mat ke jeng bena ben biya pan moy aku adaka cin juru warwo niye pinyin no macin juru warwo real pewoto panda ke kini wo adona kang adopai cing gegamu.